Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm David Cruz, in for Brian the next few days. Thank you very much for tuning in. We begin today with Monday morning politics. We now have two approved budget proposals, the Democratic Patty Murray plan and the Republican Paul Ryan budget. They are headed to committee, where lawmakers have the task of seeing if there's any common ground between the two. We begin with Karen Tumulty, who is the national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Karen, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks a lot, David. It's great to be here.
So where were you at 4:56 a.m. on Saturday morning? Because while everyone else in D.C. was sleeping and or lamenting Georgetown's loss in the first round of the NCAA tournament, Democratic senators did something that they haven't done in 4 years. They passed the budget. Is that a big deal?
It is a big deal. I'm happy to say I was asleep too. But we had the able Lori Montgomery up on the Hill watching all those dozens and dozens and dozens of votes, what they call a votorama, that led up to this. This budget is important because, for again, as you said, for the first time in 4 years, the Senate has passed one. But it has really laid out the parameters now going forward. The House and the Senate are going, for the first time in 4 years, to meet in a conference committee on the budget. The House budget is going to be Congressman Paul Ryan's, the budget committee chairman's. In the Senate, Patty Murray is going to lead the negotiators. But it kind of lays out the two different schools of thought here, the Republicans in the House depending entirely on spending cuts, and the Senate Democrats essentially arguing that higher taxes on the wealthy are going to be necessary.
This passage came after a 12-hour series of votes, that votorama, 500 amendments, 70 of them voted on. Explain to me how this works. Republicans complain that the Senate hadn't passed a budget in 4 years, and then when they bring it to a vote, there are hours and hours of amendments. Was this part of a GOP plan all along to force votes on these hot button issues under the guise of passing a budget?
Well, the budget allows a lot of amendments that wouldn't make it to the floor otherwise. And so, yes, there were a lot of symbolic, in fact, most of them were symbolic amendments. For instance, the Senate went on record in support of the Keystone Pipeline. They voted overwhelmingly that it would be a good idea to repeal the tax on medical devices that was enacted as part of the new health care law. They voted in favor of permitting states to require online retailers to collect sales taxes. You know, again, none of these things really directly affects the federal deficit, but it was a chance to get a lot of people on record. And a lot of these votes were really overwhelmingly, they were definitely bipartisan votes.
And some odd votes. I mean, Rand Paul proposing an amendment for the U.S. to withdraw from the U.N., which I guess he's done before, and five different senators proposing anti-abortion laws. All of this, I guess, an effort to just get people on the record, right, so that when an election comes along, someone can put in their campaign literature and their TV ads that this person voted this unpopular way, or I voted this popular way, right?
Yes, and sometimes it is also to make a statement, as the Keystone Pipeline vote was as well, to sort of put some pressure on things to get done in a policy setting. But the budget is kind of a unique animal, and it does allow a much more sort of open process, and that is why we saw all of these amendments.
On ABC yesterday, Democratic strategist Donna Brazile had a slightly more optimistic view of these 500 proposed amendments. Let's take a listen to that.
They had an opportunity to talk about the Keystone Pipeline. They had an opportunity to talk about a biennial budget. They had an opportunity to talk about immigration. So this gave the senators more than an opportunity to talk about big issues as well as the budgetary notes.
Also, Chairman.
So as you said, it's an opportunity to get people on the record, right?
And it is an opportunity to put these issues out there. And like I said, and as Donna seemed to agree, you know, a chance to sort of put the Senate on record on these issues.
Yeah, the budgets are really policy documents, right? The rubber hits the road in the appropriations committees. That said, Go ahead.
They are, yeah, they are primarily, they are policy documents and they are political documents. You're right. The what really matters are the spending bills, which come along later in the year.
$100 billion for an upfront job creation and infrastructure program, instructions to expedite an overhaul of the tax code that would raise $975 billion over 10 years and could not be filibustered, and spending cuts and interest savings that total $975 billion. That's according to Democratic calculations. So does the budget at least set a starting point of increased infrastructure and higher income taxes?
It does if the budget gets passed through the conference committee. This is the Senate is on record here, but again, they have to go into negotiations with the House. One thing that's interesting to know about the budget, it is not signed by the president. When Congress passes a budget, if they can agree on something in conference committee, and I am pretty pessimistic that that is going to happen. But if they can agree on something, that is it. This is the president, however, can sort of weigh in these negotiations. He has, in his so-called charm offensive with Republicans, has been talking about sort of a middle ground where he thinks he can get Democrats to back a more moderate path to deficit reduction that has $600 billion in new revenue, not the $1 trillion in the Senate budget, and also some additional spending cuts.
So does the return to this normal legislative process mean anything? I mean, does it take the president out of this process and just put Mary and Ryan and their people in the room?
I don't think so. I think that, you know, these two points of view that are going to be represented in this conference committee are sort of the extremes. And the current climate in Congress does not suggest that people are particularly inclined these days to hammer out compromises. And so I think that even if the president is not an official participant in these negotiations, he does have influence and he can certainly weigh in and perhaps nudge both sides.
You're listening to WNYC AM and FM and WNYC.org. I'm David Cruz in for Brian Lehrer this week. Karen Tumulty is with us. She is the senior national political correspondent for The Washington Post. We can take some of your calls on this. Maybe you want to suggest something that these guys may be able to agree on, or what your side of this question is. 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Karen, I know the Merry plan raises a significant amount of revenue through closing tax loopholes, both for high-income earners and corporations. And streamlining the tax code is something both Democrats and Republicans seem to like to talk about. Is there at least some common ground there?
Well, the question becomes, as you know, how what this is part of. The streamlining the tax code has been talked about as potentially being part of what people call a grand bargain that would also include entitlement reform. And that, I think, is something that everyone says they would like to do, but it's going to require a lot of political courage, which is something that is there's not a lot of in Washington now. These budget negotiations provide one opportunity for this, and there are fewer and fewer of them coming up. Though, you know, some people are very pessimistic that we're going to see this grand bargain. Other people, for instance, Virginia Senator Mark Warner, who a Democrat who would very much like to see this happen, says he thinks there's at least a 50-50 chance that we're going to see Congress and the president moving in that direction.
Which means absolutely nothing, right? A 50-50 chance means that
right,
it either
exactly.
will or it won't happen. But
you get to be right either way.
Exactly. Mitch McConnell has said several times he wants the sequester cuts to be dealt with in the budget process. So that does that make a possibility for a grand bargain even less likely?
Well, it's interesting. The sequester is it was put into place because everybody thought it was so horrible that it would be unthinkable to do this. And now it looks like it's the only thing more unthinkable is doing something else. So we've seen the sequester has now been enshrined in the so-called continuing resolution that funds the government through the remainder of the fiscal year, which ends on September 30th. We've gone from thinking this is the unthinkable to thinking that it's, you know, unthinkable to lift it.
So John Boehner, again, raised an amendment that would mandate any increase in the debt ceiling would be accompanied by equal cuts in spending. It looks like the House is gearing up for another fight around the debt ceiling, which needs to be authorized again, I guess, this summer. Is that where we're headed again?
Oh, yes. So once again, we're going to have government by crisis. And I think that that is one of the main reasons that you see people outside of Washington getting so fed up with the president's approval ratings have taken a big drop recently. Congress's would have dropped a lot if it were possible for them to drop any further.
Right.
And I think that the whole country is just getting pretty discouraged by the fact that these guys cannot seem to operate unless they create a crisis for themselves.
So is the sequester really like that pair of shoes that you bought that hurt when you walked, but then you kind of got used to them and they're a little tight, but you're still walking?
I don't know, though. I've thought that so many times, and very rarely do the shoes ever feel good.
Right.
But, it may be that these cuts start to hurt as they get further down the line. For instance, maybe some of these education cuts people are going to begin to feel with the new school year. But for now, most people feel like life is going on pretty normally.
All right, so let's switch gears to the other major story in D.C. this week. The Supreme Court is hearing two cases related to gay marriage. This is on the heels of elections to approve gay marriage in four states and the high-profile Republican Senator Rob Portman voicing his support for gay marriage. And yesterday on ABC, this exchange between George Stephanopoulos and Republican strategist Karl Rove.
Karl Rove, can you imagine the next presidential campaign, a Republican candidate saying flat out, I am for gay marriage?
I could.
Two words that I don't know that you'd ever hear Karl Rove say in answer to that question. Was that as big a moment as some of us thought?
Well, if you understand the history of Karl Rove and specifically the Bush campaign strategy on this issue, it did seem like it was a big moment. Because in 2004, when President Bush was running for reelection, there were 11 anti-gay marriage ballot initiatives on the ballot in states across the country.
It was a strategy, was it not?
It was, and every single one of them passed. They were not necessarily in battleground states, but people did see that as a tool with which the Republicans sort of increased turnout among evangelicals. But public opinion there is just no doubt what direction it is heading. In our Washington Post poll last week, we had nearly 6 in 10 Americans now saying that they support gay marriage. So I think public opinion and history, the direction is pretty clear at this point. So the question becomes, how does the Supreme Court, which is hearing two different important gay marriage cases, deal with this? Do they decide that, you know, history is going to take this issue and that they don't necessarily want to be aggressive in intervening because the direction's already been set? Or do they want to get out and ahead of it?
Now, I don't want to get too far into this because we're going to be talking to Eric Schneiderman in just a bit, but it really, the public opinion, it's been an amazing sea change in public opinion on this issue.
It is extraordinary. And it's not just because young people have decided that they can embrace gay marriage. You're even seeing among older demographics a much increasing acceptance of gay marriage. And if you look at, as several pollsters have, the exit polls of the last election, it really does seem like, you know, opposition to gay marriage is very concentrated now in some relatively small demographics, including evangelicals, white high school educated voters. But the acceptance is just growing extraordinarily.
We're going to be tracking the Supreme Court hearings all week, but as someone who watches the D.C. ecosystem, how much are the justices paying attention to the Rob Portmans of the world and vice versa? How much would this Supreme Court decision affect whether the Republican Party continues to move toward endorsing gay marriage?
Well, our Supreme Court reporter Robert Barnes has an excellent piece in the paper today, and he suggests that on issues like this, the court does pay attention to public opinion. But again, that also may make them a little bit cautious because they may decide that, you know, things are headed this way anyway, and that it's really much better to allow, you know, public sentiment to get there first rather than having this forced on people by the courts, you know, as happened with the abortion in 1973, where it, you know, public opinion was definitely going toward looser abortion laws, but by ruling, the court turned, you know, it turned out that they inflamed the issue.
Right. All right. Karen Tumulty is national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Karen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, David. It was great to be here.
Good to talk to you. We continue the conversation about this week's big Supreme Court hearing next with New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman. He's filed an amicus brief urging the court to strike down the Defense of Marriage Act. David Cruz for Brian Lehrer. More in a minute.